Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for tuning in on this Aloha Friday, September 6th. Hawaii Talks on the Conversation. Today we survey the labor landscape with the contentious talks between Hawaii Pacific Health and Hawaii Nurses, the Hawaii Nurses Union, and the recent three-day walkout by hotel workers at properties here on Oahu and Kauai. We return to the numbers on Maui fire survivors and where they are now. When will we really know how many have left? We get the latest on the spotty flight situation affecting rural areas. Tough when you have to fly to other islands for medical reasons. And a really, really big Obon dance. The city is even extending its hours for Skyline so participants can jump on the train to the old Aloha Stadium and show off their moves. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The Hawaii Nurses Association still has plans to walk off the job a week from today, Friday the 13th, even though management at Hawaii Pacific Health threatened to lock out members if they go through with the one-day strike. It's a rare move in healthcare. The two sides met virtually yesterday, but no deal has been struck. The issue is not so much wages. Management says it's offering base salaries of more than $100,000 on up, but the union says a sticking point is patient workload. We should note that it was 50 years ago, in 1974, that Hawaii saw its first nurses' strike. This morning, we talked with former labor leader J.N. Musto about the changing labor landscape. He was with the University of Hawaii Professional Assembly, the faculty union, for more than 3.5 decades, and just last year rolled off the Hawaii Labor Relations Board after several terms. Here's Musto.
Healthcare in the beginning didn't take much part of the stage, and obviously hotels were extremely important. But over my lifetime here, that has fundamentally changed the background for all of the industries of Hawaii. They have been larger conglomerates. They are no longer homegrown institutions. Again, Waikiki is a good measure of it. The health industry, the same thing. The development of Hawaii Pacific Health, of which Kapiolani is part, was a consolidation of, you know, the freestanding Straub Hospital, and then they brought in Wilcox and Palimomi and Kapiolani and so forth. Queens itself, which was always large, became even larger and more of a footprint. And I think in that whole process, what happens is the labor and employment relations situation changes. Decisions are made at different levels for different purposes. It is less, in a sense, it's almost less personal. It's not as if you were at Kuakini and these are my doctors and nurses and it's Kuakini Hospital and we, you know, need to find an answer and a solution and if we have a problem. Again, other considerations can take over.
Yeah, so really the landscape has changed over 50 years. And my immediate reaction was, okay, you know, you hear of lockouts in stories, let's say across the mainland in labor disputes, you know, at an auto factory. But for hospitals, you know, in healthcare, I was just like, wow.
Yeah, well, in the beginning of the labor movement, the lockout was often used by employers. I mean, the lockout basically is an employer saying, I really want to see how strong the membership of this union supports the actions of the union itself. And I'm not going to give control over the fact that the plant will run today or not run today solely to the union. I'm going to, as the employer, exert control over that. And that was an early on attitude, and rightfully so. The union movement, obviously, were built upon workers who were sufficient, you know, were significantly underpaid compared to the profits that were going, you know, at the turn of the 20th century to the big corporations. And the whole movement came as a portion of balancing that difference between what was paid and what was profit. And it did. You know, the funny thing about if you enjoy the middle class, thank the union. The number of unions in town repeat that, HGEA and others, and they're right. You know, we brought you the middle class. But we're now in the 21st century, you know, a gig economy. Even though you see some unionization in things like Starbucks and smaller groups within larger corporations, it's a whole different ball of wax. But going back to Kapiolani, this is unique. I could not find a point in time that any healthcare facility that was unionized made that statement, we are going to lock you out. On my side, originally, when I was representing unions and negotiating, there was once, actually, at the university, we went on a strike. We announced that we were going to go on strike, and it was before Thanksgiving. And we laid it all out for the students, the faculty, the administration. My friend Harold Masumoto, who I was bargaining with, Harold didn't believe that I could get them to walk out even for that short period of time. But we did. And it was a demonstration that the faculty, despite what they thought, would actually walk out on strike for anything. And Harold was very good in making sure that the deduction from their paychecks for the period of time they were on strike were processed before the end of the following week. But it did for us what we needed to do, and that is to say that this union does represent the feelings and attitudes of the faculty. This is not just J.N. Musto and a bunch of people from the mainland talking or something. You can't dismiss us. And we followed that up, and we reached an agreement. I think we reached the agreement in January of the following year for submission to the legislature. Again, it is when an employer believes that a union does not have the complete support of its membership for a indeterminate strike that would go on until there was an agreement reached, that they would threaten to lock them out. And from what I've read, and I know nothing about really what's going on internally in this negotiation, but I do know that it started back in 2023, it appears that the union is going to be put in a place where a lockout, in a sense, is going to be irrelevant because they're not going to get a settlement unless there is a strike. And by a strike, the strike, like the first one that I walked out with, was the UAW in 1965, the Ford plant I was working. I mean, that was a strike until it ended, until there was a settlement. Even as I read the proposal on the website for Kapi'olani Hospital that the employer had put up, it was pretty clear that they have sort of made negotiable conditions. They've put out their last, best, and final offer, and that's it. So the game for them is over. That's why we lock out.
So I guess a lot of folks will be really focused on this next week because, you know, we're talking a situation where they'll have to fly in traveling nurses if they do lock out the membership. But then, you know, you worry about the families who have children or women who are about to give birth at that hospital, wondering what's the next few months going to be like.
Well, I am absolutely certain, and again, without any knowledge, but I'm absolutely certain Kapi'olani would not have done this without a plan to handle the patients that they currently have in their hospital and facility, but also the projected number of births that might come to the hospital, and what they would do if, in fact, they had locked out the nurses, and what they are able to handle, and if they aren't, then where they can send them to other healthcare facilities.
Right, so what's the census? What's the census count in the hospital? And
I'm sure that they are not acting irrationally at all in what their responsibility is to their patients.
We're kind of in new territory here, I guess. And I was surprised to learn that the negotiations are happening virtually, you know, because I remember back in the day, you know, sitting in the hallway at the federal mediator's office at the federal building, you know, for hours on end until there was a breakthrough. And then, you know, was there a settlement? We're not, you know, or we go out on strike. And so, yeah, that's a whole nother animal.
Well, to that point, and again, without any specific knowledge of this particular negotiation, the federal mediator himself or herself could decide to call the parties together and just hold them there. And I've had it happen to me on more than one occasion. You know, we're just going to sit here until we get somewhere. And again, they fall under the National Labor Relations Act, not our law. That I was the administrative law judge on the HLRB, one of the panel of three. And our laws govern public sector bargaining and private sector bargaining that is not covered by the National Labor Relations Act, and that's agriculture. So agriculture was left out of the 1930s Act. altogether. So the only way that agricultural workers can organize is under state laws, and we do have a state law that allows our agricultural workers to organize.
It's interesting. I mean, you know, because you mentioned the landscape has changed, and you have like the ILWU, the folks that were representing the sugar workers and all of that, and then they also now represent some hotel workers on the neighbor islands. You've got Local 5 that represents some healthcare workers at Kaiser. So it's interesting to see how the unions have morphed, too.
Well, the HNA, it's my understanding, is no longer affiliated with ANA, the National Nurses Association, but is affiliated with the OPIU, which is the Office Professional Employees Union. So, yeah, I mean, these affiliations, they change, they go back and forth. But when it gets down to it, it should be at least the employer and the employees being able directly to talk to each other over their needs, wants, and desires, unaffected by outside third-party influences. Those can be, particularly in the hotel industry, more important than what's going on necessarily on the ground in Honolulu or Las Vegas or Chicago. It's a different time.
Well, and then I'm not sure what to make of these one-day, three-day walkouts. Back in the day, you know, when we had the big hotel worker strike, it was, you know, out for a couple of weeks. And the teachers union, you know, HSTA, Hawaii State Teachers, and then the faculty members. So these onesies, twosies.
No. Well, again, they are not strikes. They are protests. You have to think of them that way. In other words, we're showing the employer what we can do, how we can do it. We're not concerned about their reaction. We are doing it for the public. We want them to understand what's going on. We want them to see what the consequences are if we happen to actually go out on strike. And there comes a time when you probably have to make that decision, that it is not going to be resolved without us actually just simply going out on strike, period. So whether the employer wants to lock us out or not is irrelevant.
Well, the issue seems to be not so much wages, but workload, based on some of the nurses that I've checked in with. And so we'll see what happens. I know that they've asked for the governor's office to help intervene. I've been told that they have had the federal mediator in. He basically told them you're too far apart. So I guess we'll see what happens.
You've got to find an answer. There ultimately will be an answer. I mean, I know of corporations where strikes never ended and employees were ultimately replaced entirely. And it's an awful situation. And that's in the industrial sector. That's not in the health sector. So you don't want to go down a path where it just sort of dies by attrition.
And then we're in a shortage situation here. And we're an island and it's not so easy to find nurses, 600 nurses overnight.
And it amazes me what resources seem to be available to bring in traveling nurses to the island. I mean, they are significantly more costly than, you know, working with the healthcare staff that you have here.
That was Jan Musto surveying the changing labor landscape and the recent threat by Hawaii Pacific Health to lock out its nurses at Kapi'olani if they go ahead with a one-day walkout next Friday. Musto most recently served on the Hawaii Labor Relations Board under Governor David Ige and Governor Josh Green until last fall. He was previously executive director for the University Faculty Union for 35 years.
Support for HPR comes from the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, committed to supporting Native Hawaiians impacted by the Maui wildfires. Applications for its Kanaho grant accepted through October 10th at oha.org/kanahogrant.
On the next Science Friday, there's a new type of ant in New York City, and scientists are learning how it's interacting with other urban insects.
So now we have this sort of mix of species from all over the world that are coming together. And I guess, you know, much like humans, are sharing their culinary culture and exchanging foods.
A closer look at the Manhattan ant. That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, celebrating 75 years, offering the distance learning executive MBA and Master of HR Management. Scheidler.hawaii.edu/executive.
You know, this week we've been taking a closer look at data and how it drives policy decisions. We heard how numbers on Maui fire survivors' whereabouts isn't as robust as it seems, even as estimates are informing major steps in the recovery effort. Today we're asking, how did it get this way and what can we do to fix it? The conversation's Maddie Bender picks up the story of the Perez family.
Brazely and Sergio Perez moved their family to Las Vegas after they lost their home in the Lahaina fire. Despite having to find new jobs and fundraise to fix their car, they told KTNV Las Vegas reporter Abel Garcia that they made the right decision to leave Maui.
Could you say that this was probably the best decision to move to Las Vegas?
Yes, yeah. This is the best decision that we have made, especially for our kids. But us being here, it feels right. It feels good. We get sad at times.
Yeah.
Now we're here in a whole new life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're making it work. We're adjusting.
How many others are like the Perez family? We just don't know. 4,000, an early estimate, is based on incomplete information. Everyone agrees that this number, known as outmigration, is critical to recovery efforts, whether for building enough housing or making sure survivors don't fall through the cracks. So how did we end up in a situation where we don't know how many people have left Maui? Matt Jakowski was Director of Data, Technology, and Innovation for the Council for Native Hawaiian Advancement until June. He put together some of the earliest reports and estimates in the immediate aftermath of the fires. CNHA and the University of Hawaii Economic Research Organization, UHERO, cared about the data from the start. But Jakowski says they were some of the only ones who did.
From my perch, like, there was nobody who was making a serious look at the data in the first several months after the fire, maybe except for me and the work I was doing. UHERO had published like a few briefs, but they were largely just waiting for these larger data sets they typically work with to come out. But in the immediate aftermath of the fire, I didn't run into a single other person who was engaging with the data in any deep way and trying to inform decision making.
How did that feel for you?
Oh, super frustrating, right? Like, so I'm technical, and I know people, for example, on Maui who are technical also. And I knew I'm like far from the only person with the skills to kind of understand this data and try to help. And what I saw was that there were people on Maui helping and who continue to help and spend a lot of their time and energy trying to help. But basically no one with the technical skills was doing it. You had people make their donation and then they moved on with their lives. And it was really sad to me to see that our residents who live here and had, you know, like front row seats to this recovery that was happening, didn't engage in any deeper way. In fact, when I was starting to do my work, there were people who had left Maui who worked in the technical fields. You know, a guy from Lahaina who went to Lahaina Luna who works at Microsoft now, a classmate of mine from Maui High School who's getting a PhD at University of Maryland now. They're the people who reached out to me to help, people who no longer live here, right? But who grew up here. But the kind of the technical people who live here now, who are largely transplants, they just weren't interested in helping, and they did not help in terms of applying their skills to the problem when their skills were sorely needed. So yeah, it was very lonely and very frustrating to try to work on the data problem early on.
One of the issues with the data on where Maui residents went is that researchers were working with numbers that represent a small slice of the total pie. But another issue is that it took time for the researchers to gain access to the data. And in certain cases, they were refused access entirely. The People's Fund of Maui, which was established by Oprah Winfrey and Dwayne The Rock Johnson, distributed money to more than 8,100 Maui residents. But Jakowski says that the People's Fund declined to share any information it had collected from residents it helped, like their names or addresses. The Entertainment Industry Foundation, which manages the People's Fund of Maui, said in a statement that the fund does not have permission to share personal information about its beneficiaries, including their banking information. They added that the fund began payments within 4 to 6 weeks of its establishment. Even when organizations were happy to share their data for research purposes, jumping through all the hoops was a tedious process. Jakowski again.
Every single time you want to ask for this relevant information from an organization, you have to go through, like, at a minimum, a week's long and often a month long process of signing data sharing agreements and getting lawyers involved. And sometimes they just don't want to do it. To get FEMA data, CNHA, it took months to get access to the FEMA data. I don't think we had access to the FEMA data until early December.
Wow.
Right? And there was no pushback from anyone involved, FEMA or the state or anybody, about whether we should get access to the data, but just that's how slow these bureaucracies churn, right? Even in the aftermath of a disaster. It's very hard to help people when you don't have a good sense of what the problems are, right? If you don't have that data, you actually can't help people as well. And it's structurally, there's just huge problems when every organization collects data and keeps it behind their wall. And even though they might be willing to share it, if the process of sharing that is really onerous and takes a really long time, it's just very hard to practically make use of it.
When I spoke to Bob Fenton, FEMA's Region 9 administrator, he stressed that barriers to sharing sensitive information, like a person's whereabouts, stem from FEMA's mandate to safeguard survivors' privacy. Still, his agency realizes there's work to be done. One solution they've gotten behind is federal legislation to reform the process. A House bill called the Disaster Survivors Fairness Act would establish a unified disaster application system, essentially a one-stop shop for assistance and a central registry that FEMA would manage. Hawaii representatives Ed Case and Joe Takuda have co-sponsored the bill in the U.S. House. FEMA's administrator has been supportive of the measure, too. The measure currently awaits a vote on the House floor. There's some good news on the horizon. Carl Bonham, executive director of UHERO, says his organization recently contracted to purchase United States Postal Service data that will show how many people have changed their address from Maui to another place and vice versa. Those numbers will likely become available to UHERO in January. Likewise, the state's Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism is tracking data from the U.S. Census Bureau and expects to have a clear estimate by December of just how many people have left Maui. But decision makers have already relied on early, incomplete estimates of outmigration to shape priorities in recovery. Bonham says the situation has underscored the value of surveying groups of people across the state over time so that UHERO won't get caught flat-footed again.
You know, obviously, we would like to learn from our mistakes, if you will.
Right now, researchers are stuck waiting for these national data sets. Information that we needed months ago, Jakowski says.
You know, people like UHERO and the State Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism, and other kind of like standard economic research organizations that might take on a question like this, the data sources they use are these data sources that, you know, maybe they're updated once a year, or maybe they're updated every 10 years, like the census. And waiting for that data to be updated is just like, I think, frankly, it's not acceptable to just wait for that data to become available when you're dealing with a disaster.
He says there could have been a concerted effort early on to focus on the data and collect it in one place. Instead, responders lost a valuable opportunity.
I think each time you were majorly helping some fire survivors, that's a golden opportunity to collect systematic data on how they're doing in their recovery. And I think the lesson I take away from this is that if there was one standard kind of like a survey on the important questions, if we had created that back at the beginning of the fire, and that was just the standard survey that went out as part of the application process for every major aid program, we would have very rich data and a very good understanding on where people are now. And it's really a missed opportunity that we didn't do that.
We won't feel some of the impacts of these decisions for years to come. Some will affect displaced residents' desires and abilities to come back to Maui, like the Perez family, who relocated to Las Vegas from Lahaina. CNHA's executive director, Kuhio Lewis, says that when he thinks about outmigration, he focuses on the people, not the data, because it was the people who made Lahaina what it was, and they deserve to be a part of Maui's future.
I mean, our hope and everything that we're trying to do is really to keep people home. We've lost so many of them already. Hawaii was already losing our population before the fire. So really, you know, what's underneath all of this for us as a Hawaiian organization is we got to keep the fabric of Hawaii. And everyone that leaves this state is part of that fabric. And if anything, my hope is that they start to come back home.
That was part two of our story about how many Maui residents have left the Valley Isle. We reached out to Representative Jill Takuda about the Disaster Survivors Fairness Act, and she sent us a statement. If Maui has taught us anything, it is the need to prevent the disaster after the disaster. Federal assistance to help with the rebuilding process after a disaster is crucial, yet the application process for each agency can be lengthy, confusing, and oftentimes re-traumatizing. She says if the Disaster Survivors Fairness Act is passed, it would streamline applications and lessen the burden that victims already face. She adds, after enduring great loss, the last thing a disaster victim needs is the stress of trying to navigate through numerous documents. If our priority truly is to take care of people, we need to make the process simpler so they can focus on healing and moving forward. The measure is now awaiting a vote on the House floor.
In celebration of the 25th anniversary of The Sopranos, HBO is premiering a new documentary about its landmark TV series. On the next Fresh Air, we feature archive interviews with David Chase, the show's creator, Michael Imperioli, who played Tony's impulsive nephew, Christopher, and Lorraine Bracco, who played Tony's therapist. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following Science Friday.
Technology is a funny thing. What was once revolutionary is practically obsolete.
We used to use the fax machine a lot.
We had ledger cards, which nobody probably even knows what a ledger card is.
I'm laughing thinking about this. Get a disposable camera.
I'm Kristen Schwab. A look at the tools we used to use at work, next time on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6, following All Things Considered.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Today, we're testing your knowledge of music and military history. In August 1945, a budding musician enlisted in the Navy to avoid the draft. He was stationed in the Manana Barracks at Pearl Harbor, a far cry from the weather back in his home state of North Carolina. He participated in kitchen and security duties, even though most would agree his talents lay elsewhere. His fellow Corps members recognized this young man's musical talent early on and featured him as a guest in the bass's swing band, the Melody Masters. While stationed in Hawaii, this man even made his first amateur recordings on the island, titled The Oahu Sessions. Pretty smooth. Although most people remember this man for what he would go on to do after he was discharged, and that's become one of the most influential artists of his genre in the 20th century. For today's backyard quiz, can you tell us who we are talking about? Call 808-941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right wins a reusable HPR tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing access to affordable housing to those with intellectual and developmental disabilities, including ARC of Maui County. NareitHawaii.com. ¶¶
The travel woes for neighbor islands has been in the headlines in recent months, with Mokulele Airlines spotty service on rural areas like Molokai and Lanai. A tough situation for residents who may fly off island for medical reasons. Here to talk about that is our Maui Nui reporter, Catherine Kluwit-Pachtel. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Yeah, so what you got for us?
So, as you said, issues with airline transportation reliability is nothing new for the communities of Molokai and Lanai, unfortunately. But what is new is that the state has appropriated $2 million as a line item in this year's state budget for the next 2 years to be able to help solve these access issues for healthcare on Molokai and Lanai. So it's called the Essential Rural Medical Air Transport Program. Whew. And it's a pilot project, so it's the first of its kind, and they'll kind of be seeing how it works, and hopefully it'll be successful, and we'll, you know, they'll go from there. The Department of Health is actually administering the funds as the fiscal intermediary for this program. Lauren Kim is with the Department of Health. He's chief of the Office of Planning, Policy, and Program Development, and he has really stressed that this program has to be community-driven.
There are long-standing problems with healthcare access for residents of Molokai and Lanai, and the legislature appropriated funds. So we've got resources to provide the community, and if they are willing to step up and put together a really well-thought-out plan that is realistic and affordable, they will have the opportunity to improve healthcare access and their quality of life, but it needs to come from the community. So we're asking the communities, the residents of Lanai and Molokai, to step up to the plate and accept this challenge with the support of the Department of Health and their community to make it happen. The budget was enacted in July, so the money technically became legal as of this state fiscal year. And my team has been doing key informant interviews with healthcare providers, local not-for-profit, nonprofits, airlines for the past 2 months. The Lanai Town Hall was our first major milestone where we're had the first opportunity to share what we thought this project could be, and also to gauge how the community would receive it, and they received it very well. They were very excited about this opportunity. We're going to have a Molokai town hall towards the end of this calendar year, and in between, we're going to be working with what we hope are leaders in each community.
Yeah, communications are key for this service.
Absolutely. So they just held that town hall meeting on Lanai recently. And from data provided to the Department of Health, 83% of Molokai residents say they experience delays in access to health care. And about 77% of Lanai residents say they experience those delays. And so those could be coming, they cite airline delays as the number one cause, sort of to be expected here, followed by just the need to travel off island for that care and the availability of appointments. It's also interesting that the Lanai community ranked their priorities for healthcare. So part of this is prioritizing, you know, who is going to get this service, figuring out all those details. And they said that transportation was their number one concern, followed by access to specialists, you know, because there's not a lot of specialists available on these rural islands. And then quality of healthcare came sort of farther down in their ranking, as well as emergency medical services was ranked last for their community. So that was based on some feedback that they received there on Lanai. So how this will work, it'll be a request for proposals that will be released by the Department of Health later this year or in early 2025. And there are still lots of details to work out, but Lauren Kim explains how it could all work.
So the HUI or not-for-profit with which we will contract can pay themselves. So if they need to hire somebody to be a scheduler or to be a travel coordinator at, you know, $20, $25 an hour, rent some small office space and computer equipment, that's all well within reason. After speaking with the health plans, having a coordinator who can just tie things together, who knows what's going on, who knows what airline is at capacity on what day, who can work with providers in Honolulu to maximize patient flow. So, for example, we dreamed up Molokai Mondays, where a certain hospital could see expectant mothers from Molokai, 8 appointments lined up on Monday. So we can maximize, if we charter a plane and fill it with Molokai residents to fly to Honolulu, is there a health system that can see all those patients on that same day? So that'd be one example of how a travel coordinator on the island of Molokai and have one on the island of Lanai can really pull together all the players and all the information to make something greater than the sum of its parts.
Yeah, that's what we need. We need some innovation, creative ideas to find a solution to this.
Definitely, and it sounds like, you know, the Department of Health is really taking a back seat in this process, you know, being there to assist these communities in brainstorming, and, you know, hopefully some good will come out of it. This is a pilot project that's similar to a bill proposed by Representative Mahina Poipoi this past legislative session that actually died in the Senate. But, you know, its goal lives on. Senator Linda Coit calls it an agreement between the House and the Senate to appropriate these funds. De Coit is from Molokai, and she, you know, of course, has talked about the frustrations firsthand with, with Mokulele being a monopoly, the delays, the cancellations, you know, causing patients to regularly miss those off-island appointments. And so the intent behind this whole project is for a nonprofit or another local group, as Lauren Kim mentioned, to coordinate the program. And so they would, you know, be the bidding on this RFP that will be released. Technically, it could also be the airline that could bid on the program and coordinate all of this. Kim says competition will be a focus of the RFP, though, and so he stressed that it's not going to be a monopoly situation. It could involve chartered flights. It could involve buying seats on commercial flights, but more than one airline, he says, will definitely be involved. So Linda Coit says she's been trying to focus the RFP on smaller charter airlines to exclude Mokulele from potentially, you know, being the main carrier for this program.
Who's to say that the airline might want to bid on it themselves to do the RFP, right? So I'm hoping that the community from both Lanai and Molokai can come up with something that would allow them ownership of this program on how we want to help our communities, more so Kupuna and the kids. Because you and I know, just to get on pediatrician, just to try and get kupunas onto an airline without a ramp is really tough. Also, you know, stuff came out about like providers. How do we get the providers or specialists instead of moving people on an airline that is very not dependable at that point? Some of the responses we've had from Lanai was, well, we don't have housing. And, you know, there's an affordable housing project coming online. But it's a matter of whether or not that county affordable housing project will commit to blocking out and saying, okay, this has been a priority. We need housing for specialists that are willing to come in. On the flip side of it, when I met with the specialists from Queens and Maui Memorial, they were like, Lynn, it's not a problem for us to come in. It's the equipment we will need to help us assist with patients that these pieces of equipment can run us anywhere from $250,000 to $500,000.
Yeah, it can get complicated pretty fast. But yeah, your heart just breaks for the patients that, let's say, need to come over here for a chemo treatment or something like that. It's tough.
Yeah, so many challenges over the past couple of years with that. And, you know, as DeCoit talked about, so many factors to take into consideration. Hopefully this will be really a starting point for, as you said, innovation and looking at some of those solutions. You know, is it bringing providers to the islands of Molokai and Lanai, or is it, you know, really using this to facilitate those flights to make it possible for them to be more timely to make those appointments that they need?
All right. Well, thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank you.
That was HVR's Catherine Kluwet-Pachtel talking about the new medical air travel pilot program. You can find her stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Osher Lifelong Learning Institute for ages 50 and older, with courses designed to engage the mind and enrich lives. Classes begin September 23rd. More by searching OLLIUHM.
I'm Anita Rao. Medical advances mean that living a full, healthy life with HIV is very possible. But when it comes to dating and relationships, there is a learning curve.
we have to navigate this new area where I'm positive, my partner is negative, and how do we, you know, maintain that relationship?
Sex and dating with HIV. Join us next time on Embodied.
Beginning this evening at 7.
Now it's time to reveal the answer to our backyard quiz. Earlier, we asked you to identify a mystery musician who served in the Navy here in Hawaii. We're jazzed to tell you that we were looking for John Coltrane. The famous musician has been recognized around the world for his talent and musicality, even being honored posthumously with a special Pulitzer Prize. But he started with his first recording in 1946, titled The Oahu Sessions, on which he played the alto saxophone on a range of jazz standards and bebop tunes. And I wondered if anyone was going to get this, and congrats to Peter Holland from Kula, you got it right. That's today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. One season comes to a close this month, the perfect time to hold what's billed as the ultimate community Obon dance festival, Megabon. The event was first held last year, and organizers expected 5,000 people. They got 15,000. This year, attendance is expected to top that. Cosmo Hirai is a co-chair of the organizing committee. The Conversation's Russell Subiono sat down with Hirai in our studio to discuss the origins of the Japanese festival in honoring our ancestors.
I first learned about Bon from Karate Kid Part 2.
I didn't even know.
So, like, whenever I see something come up for, like, a Bon dance or something like that, all I think of is...
Mr. Sato, you know, our Bon dance is soon, and it's going to be real hard the way things are to have it here in the village.
So what do you ask of me?
Well, can they have it in the castle? That's where it really belongs anyway, isn't it?
Your student become my teacher. Obon will be held in castle. Now and forever.
So that's all I really know about Obon. I think I kind of know that it's festival in honor of ancestors.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about the history of Obon as it's celebrated in Japan?
So Obon did start about 600 years ago. You know, the story goes there was a priest, Mokuden, that he would have certain powers that he was able to use. And he noticed that his mother, unfortunately, in a very bad place in the afterworld, and wanted to get her up to somewhere better. He asked the Buddha what he could do. He said, you know, 3 days, three nights, do offerings. And then at the end of those 3 days, he noticed that his mother was able to ascend to a better place. And the story also goes that he was so happy and he was so overjoyed that his mother was in a better place that he danced, and that dance would become the Obon dance.
So it's a celebratory occasion, a celebratory dance. What I remember most from the way that Obon was portrayed in Karate Kid was the dance. And it seemed that all of the community knew how to do the motions and they did it all in unison. Can you talk about the dance that is performed at Obon festivals? Is there only one traditional dance or are there many?
Oh, yeah, no. Obon, the dance, there is many, 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 many. It depends on what region, what area you are from Japan. You know, they'll have different dances, different songs, different styles. You know, even Okinawa has their own version of the Obon dance and the Obon festival. And so depending where you go, it'll always change. The interesting part about that is that when you come to Hawaii, it's such a melting pot. Right. You get to see all the different dances in one night.
Yeah, and glad you brought that up, because I know that Japanese immigrants first arrived here in 1885. I know they brought many of their traditions with them, and as they built their lives here, they engaged with those traditions. Do you think that Obon has evolved in its time here in the nearly, you know, 140 years since the Japanese have come to Hawaii?
Oh, yes. I mean, Hawaii is just such an interesting place, right? You have so many different cultures. You have so many different thoughts coming in. And then even within Japan, you know, there's so many different prefectures. And when you put them all together in Hawaii, Obon changes. It has become something different altogether. The idea of still, you know, honoring your ancestors is still there. But in Hawaii, it is have a different feel, different sense to it than you would when you go to Japan. But I think that's one of the beauties of it, right? It's the idea of it's evolving. It's becoming something that is meant for Hawaii, not just Japan thing.
Yeah.
It's our cultural thing in Hawaii.
So when somebody goes to an Obon dance and maybe they're not from that area or that community, how do you pick up the moves? Is it easy to kind of just learn the dance as you go along?
You know, I would like to say it's kind of easy when you can watch somebody ahead of you. But there's a lot of groups out there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they have their professionals doing it. And when I'm by myself, I have no idea what I'm doing. But usually when you go to these Obon dances, they have the professional groups. They're set themselves within the dance circle. And you can follow them. And okay. You pick up on it little by little, yeah.
That's always, I think, my biggest fear is that I won't know or I won't catch on fast enough at an Obon dance. But it seems like it's set up in a way where a beginner could probably pick it up pretty quickly.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can just go right in, follow the person ahead of you. That's what I usually do. I have no idea how to do the Obon dance. And I just watch them. And I realize I'm making a fool out of myself. But I think that's part of the fun.
Oh, okay. Okay. And from what I've read, Obon is a time to remember and appreciate ancestors and their sacrifices. When we think about the generation that's alive today that has ancestral ties to Japan or to the Japanese that immigrated here, do you think today's generation would especially benefit from understanding and learning the significance of Obon?
I mean, I think it doesn't matter what generation you're in. When you're talking about your ancestors and you're talking about those that came before you, I think anywhere, any generation would benefit. We have to understand, Obon is about understanding and thanking, you know, our ancestors, regardless of the good or the bad. Everything they've done in their life has led to us being alive today. And being able to understand that, we can look more into the future for our next generations.
I love the parallels between Obon and the way the Hawaiian culture also venerates their ancestors as well. For those that are not Japanese, for kind of like outsiders, what do you think those people can gain or learn from participating in Obon?
You know, even if they're not part of it, right? Buddhism, Obon, it's not really a religion in itself. You know, it's really a lifestyle just of understanding and thanking the world and everything that we've been giving. So what they can take away from it is understanding that our ancestors left us something. And that because of that, we're here today. At the same time, because we know that's what they've done, we should be able to do better for our descendants,
yeah.
Right? So anyone can take away that lesson.
I know there are several Obon dance opportunities scheduled around our state, usually starting in June and lasting through late September. Megabon is one of the final events in the dance calendar, and it's billed as the ultimate community Obon dance event. Can you talk about, and I don't know how you can say Megabon without the sound effects, right? Can you talk about Megabon, what it is and why it was created?
Yeah, I mean, one, I don't want to say it's the last one. There's so many other great ones coming out after us, and we're not like the biggest or anything either. You know, we're just trying to put on a really good community event for Hawaii. But Megabon, yeah, it was an interesting thought that kind of came up. When I was younger, I noticed there wasn't a lot of very Japanese-style matsuris or festivals in Hawaii. And then that kind of went away, and then somewhere around 2017, I took over the temple. I ended up joining the JCs, or JCI Honolulu. And from there, I realized my capability and my capacity in being able to do certain things. And I realized when I met all these great people and these individuals, you know, like-minded and the same age as me, I realized if we put our efforts together, we could do something great. And then that's when it first clicked that this is possible. We could do an Obon festival for the community. And then along with that, I am the bishop for Toldaiji Hawaii, and my temple has never done a Obon dance ever. And I thought it'd be a great way to kind of just come together and just do something nice. And we ended up saying, okay, we'll figure it out. We have no idea what we're doing. We're just going to go out. We're going to figure it out. We put it together. And eventually we ended up having another idea on it. Another idea. Another idea. And our committee just kept going. And especially the chair, Jenna Nakagawa, you know, she put so much time and effort that when the day came and we were expecting maybe 5,000 people at best, We ended up with 15,000 people. Wow. It was just overwhelming, and now we're here today.
What kind of things will happen at Megabon? Is it just the dance? Is there food and drink and other types of things there?
Oh, there's a lot of things to do at Megabon. Yeah, obviously there will be the dancing. You know, there are going to be prize giveaways. There's going to be over 100 vendors. We're going to have foods. Will there be crafts? We'll have a drone show by Sky Elements Hawaii. Ooh. And then our presenting sponsor, Hawaiian Telcom, who's also going to be having a fiber optic Wi-Fi for our VIPs in the beer garden area. But there will be, you know, all of that. There's also going to be games, handmade games, by the way, by a lot of the committee members and the families of the temple. Built hand games for the children or even adults if you want to play. I would play it.
Yeah. Sounds fun. Well, now that we're so hyped up for Megabon, can you tell our listeners the details of how they can participate?
Well, it is a free event. You know, it's a community event. This is what we've been trying to aim for. We're trying not to make money off of it, but just to make sure that Hawaii has somewhere to come. So if you come, your only cost is going to be what you want to spend at the event. At the vendors, there is going to be a fee for parking at the Aloha Stadium, but there's no fee if you take the rail, because rail is going to be open till 10 o'clock for us.
Oh, nice.
LCC is going to be having their parking lot open, so if you want to come from the leeward side, if you want to do ride share, we'll have a drop-off location for you ready to go. And then besides that, any other way you want to come, carpooling, bicycle.
Skateboard. Yeah. Awesome. It's Saturday, September 7th, right? At yes. Aloha Stadium in the parking lot. What time do gates open?
The doors are going to open from 4 o'clock till 9 o'clock. It's going to be in the lower Halava lot.
Awesome. Well, Cosmo Hirai, thanks so much for your time today, man. It was so much fun talking to you about Obon and about Megabon.
No, thank you. Thank you very much for having me here today.
And that was Hawaii Todaiji Bishop Cosmo Hirai talking with HPR's Russell Subiono. The second annual Megabon will take place tomorrow, Saturday, September 7th, in the lower Halava parking lot of Aloha Stadium, starting at 4 p.m. The event is free, open to all. We'll have a link to more information on the conversation page of our website later today. Well, that's it for this Aloha Friday. Coming up next week, the Native Hawaiian Civic Clubs honors two sisters who've been working behind the scenes over the many decades to strengthen bonds in the Native Hawaiian community here and abroad. Got feedback? Call 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can listen back to our shows on the conversation page of our website or as podcasts on Spotify, Apple, or Google. Our program is produced by Russell Subiono, Lillian Song, and Maddie Bender, with support from Savannah Harriman-Pote and Tori DeJournay. The Backyard Quiz written for us by John DeMello, and our theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.